The mass annihilation of the beaver was one of America's ecological original sins. Today, how humans work alongside beavers on behalf of hydro infrastructure and the planet. From SDPB, this is In the Moment. From species diversity to wildlife and drought mitigation, the humble beaver serves as nature's architect. Yet even urban areas like Rapid City have struggled mightily with beaver management this year. We spend the hour talking about the role of the beaver in South Dakota. We'll explore the history of the industrial fur trade and how beavers were airdropped in the 1940s as a way to repopulate the landscape. And we'll look at how landowners and scientists are working in tandem to understand and leverage the power of a keystone species. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Beavers are a keystone species in South Dakota watersheds, but they can also have a devastating effect on a landscape, at least as far as humans are concerned. We're spending this hour exploring the role of beavers in South Dakota, and we'll start with the big picture with author Ben Goldfarb. His 2018 book is called Eager: The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Goldfarb is an award-winning environmental journalist. He holds a Master of Environmental Management degree from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. His work has been featured in Scientific American, The Guardian, and High Country News. I asked him how he learned to love the beaver.
I grew up in the Hudson Valley in New York, hiking, camping, fishing. You know, I was always around beavers. I thought they were interesting and cool, but I didn't fully appreciate them until 2014. I was living in Seattle at the time, and I attended this beaver workshop. Somebody sent me an advertisement for it. I didn't know what a beaver workshop was, but it sounded like it could be a fun time and a cool story. And at this beaver workshop, it was just one scientist after another getting up to say their piece about how important beavers were for, you know, salmon and trout habitat creation, for water quality improvement, for storing water in the face of drought and climate change, for preventing flooding, for, you know, mitigating wildfires. Beavers provided all of these wonderful, cool services. And, you know, I realized that beavers weren't just this cool, fun, interesting rodent that I had grown up around. They were actually one of the most important tools of ecological restoration we had. So that was really what started me on this this journey.
All right. But they are pretty cool. Evolutionary marvel. Tell us some of the things, from fur-lined lips to how they use their tails, that make this rodent so fascinating.
Yeah, you know, beavers are just incredible critters. And of course, they're semi-aquatic rodents, right? So they spend pretty much their whole lives in and around water. And they've got all kinds of amazing adaptations for that unique, you know, aquatic niche they fill. They've got one of the thickest pelts in the animal kingdom. So they've got as many individual hairs on a postage stamp size patch of skin as we have on our entire heads, right? So they've got these really thick pelts, which, you know, were their downfall, and we'll probably talk about that too. But they've, you know, they've got those wonderful fur-lined second set of lips. They can actually close their second lips behind their front teeth like a valve, so they can chew and drag branches underwater without drowning. They've got a second set of eyelids, transparent eyelids called a nictitating membrane, that act as goggles underwater. And then that tail is, you know, probably their most iconic, recognizable feature. And, you know, the tail is really a cool multi-purpose Swiss Army knife. It's a fat storage device. They actually put on fat for the winter in their tails. It's a kickstand out on land. It's a rudder while they swim. And it's an alarm system, right? When they smack their tail on the water, they're doing that to warn other beavers about the presence of predators. So the tail is doing all kinds of interesting work.
So what are you listening for if you're out on a watershed early in the morning or at dusk? How do you know you've heard a beaver warn that you're nearby? They see you and they know it and they send the warning out. What's it sound like?
It sounds like somebody has taken like a big, you know, cement block or something and chucked it into the water. It's like a big kerploosh. It's a pretty recognizable sound once you've heard it a few times.
All right, so we have to reconfigure our imagination before we get to how many millions of these animals were eradicated during the industrial fur trade. We have to rethink what North America even looked like. What was the landscape like with millions and millions of beavers? And what do we, how do we know that? What kind of records did you find that, that showed people talking about it in either oral history or in writing from Westerners who were exploring?
Yeah. Well, you know, first you have to think about what beavers do, right? So beavers build dams, and those dams create ponds and wetlands. And those ponds and wetlands are capable of covering enormous amounts of land. And so, you know, we know that historically, lots of the streams that we see today that are just these, you know, kind of single thread, you know, pieces of spaghetti winding across the floodplain actually would have been these big chains of ponds and wetlands created by beaver dams. And, you know, it's just amazing to think about how ubiquitous and abundant and influential this animal was. You know, you read accounts from Lewis and Clark, for example, you know, traveling up the Missouri River in 1805. And, you know, they talk about seeing beaver dams up every single tributary as far as the eye can see up into the mountains, you know, as when they get to Montana. And certainly they were seeing plenty of that in the Dakotas as well. You know, there are accounts from explorers crossing, you know, what is today Indiana and not finding a dry place to camp for 100 miles because beavers had just ponded everything up. So this was an animal that was all over the place. And there's no question that all of those hundreds of millions of beaver ponds and wetlands would have made the landscape much greener and bluer and wetter and lusher than it is today. There are, you know, places in the American West that we basically consider desert now, where there are accounts of trappers finding these lush marshes full of waterfowl. And, you know, that was largely beavers doing.
So when you mention waterfowl, how does the beaver's presence change the entire ecosystem? Who else comes along when beavers do their work?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost hard to name an animal that doesn't benefit from beavers somehow. You know, we've got all of the other semi-aquatic mammals. You know, we've got muskrat and mink and otter and moose, you know, all showing up to those ponds and wetlands. We've got, you know, all kinds of birds, not just waterfowl, but also wading birds and songbirds. I've seen huge numbers of hummingbirds around beaver ponds because they're all feeding on the flowers, the kind of the wetland flowers that have sprung up when beavers cut down trees to open up the canopy. And then we know, you know, we know that that fish are huge beaver beneficiaries, right? If you're, you know, a little baby trout, you don't want to live in a free-flowing, fast-moving main stem river. You want to live in a kind of a slow side channel or a meander or an eddy or a deep pool where you can kind of take it easy, conserve your energy, eat some aquatic insects, and, you know, stay away from herons and kingfishers, right? You want that complex slow water refuge habitat that beavers create. So there are lots of studies showing that beavers are really good for trout and salmon production.
All right, let's get to what the heck happened. Because you mentioned those beautiful pelts, which are incredibly soft, and it's portable wealth. Like we think of diamonds today, it's you can move it pretty easily once you have a beaver pelt, and it was worth a lot of money. Help us understand how quickly that landscape changed because of Western colonization.
Yeah, it was, you know, in geological terms, it was almost instantaneous. You know, the fur trade really begins in New England in the early 1600s and spreads west and south across the continent pretty rapidly. And, you know, by the early 1800s, it's reached the Rocky Mountains and the Pacific coast. And, you know, by 1840 or so, you know, you would have been pretty hard pressed to find a beaver anywhere in the lower 48. You know, they were nearly functionally extinct. There were still, you know, a handful up in Canada, but, you know, certainly the Dakotas would have been beaverless, you know, by the early 1800s. It was really, really rapid.
So it's an ecological devastation then.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, when you trap out several hundred million beavers, as, you know, the industrial fur trade did, well, you know, all of those beaver dams break down and all of those ponds drain and all of those lush wetlands and ponds that were such good wildlife habitat, you know, they all disappear and lots of streams become really eroded and degraded and incised and, you know, lose a lot of their value as fish and wildlife habitat. So, you know, we often, when we talk about the kind of the environmental changes that happened in North America, you know, we talk about deforestation in New England and the busting of the sod in the Midwest and, you know, gold mining in the Sierra Nevada. But we don't often talk about fur trapping as, you know, being kind of the original sin that the colonists committed against American landscapes.
A lot of people must make a lot of money on that. How is this as an economic driver? Like, how does that trade then intersect with politics, with conflict, war, the Revolutionary War? I mean, everything is driven by, it's hard to imagine how much they were influencing the political scene as well.
I mean, practically every significant historical event prior to the Civil War in American history has some kind of beaver connection, right? The American Revolution, you know, one of the British offenses that angered the colonists was denying them access to trapping grounds west of the Appalachians. You know, the Louisiana Purchase, that was partly inspired by Jefferson trying to secure new lands for beaver trapping. The War of 1812 had a deep beaver connection. That was called the Beaver War. And then, of course, it was those beaver trappers and traders who spread smallpox and other diseases that, you know, really ravaged many Native American tribes. So, the story of the fur trade is sort of the story of early America, and all of its grandeur and tragedy, you know. And I mean, to me, one of the really telling, indications of how significant the fur trade was as an economic driver was that the Oregon Territory, which historically covered everything from the Pacific Ocean to Wyoming, actually minted a beaver coin, a little coin with a picture of a beaver on it. And so the value of one beaver coin was fixed to one beaver pelt. So the entire economy of, you know, something like a quarter of the country operated on the pelt standard. I think that's pretty extraordinary.
At what point do Americans, European Americans, the government, scientists, regular people start saying we need to reintroduce the beaver or save the beaver or change? Does the trade fizzle out, or is there a concentrated decision that it's gone too far?
Yeah, it's a good question. The trade mostly fizzles out in the mid 19th century as, you know, people run out of beavers to trap, and also silk becomes sort of commonly imported from China, and silk hats actually replace the fur hat as kind of the style of the day. At that point, beavers have gone from up to 400 million to down to 100,000 or so. So their numbers are dramatically reduced, and they're pretty much all up in Canada. But around 1900 or so, a handful of states say, hey, wait a second, you know, these animals are really worth more alive than dead. And states begin to reintroduce beavers, you know, often using animals from Yellowstone National Park, where there are still a few hanging on, often using Canadian animals. And, you know, beaver populations kind of start to tick up in the early 1900s. And today we probably have something like 10 to 15 million beavers in North America, right? So they're not an endangered species. They're not going to go extinct anytime soon. But, you know, we're still at a tiny fraction of what their populations used to be.
All right. So tell us some of the stories of original ideas, including parachuting in beavers to try some of the ways that we decided that we were going to reintroduce beavers into the landscape.
Yeah, the parachuting beavers is such a great classic story. So, you know, the situation there was in the 1940s, the late 1940s, Idaho was trying to reintroduce beavers to what is today the Frank Church Wilderness area, kind of in the middle of the state. And first, you know, they tried moving the beavers on horseback. And the beavers didn't take very kindly to that. The horses definitely didn't like having these, you know, big smelly rodents strapped to their backs. So then, you know, one of these biologists had the bright idea of using parachutes, right? It was 1948 at this point. It was just after after World War II. And so there were all of these surplus parachutes and airplanes on hand. And so they basically designed these special crates, packed the beavers in, and then started chucking them out of airplanes with parachutes attached. And in 1948, they airdropped 76 beavers. 75 of the beavers survived. One beaver, unfortunately, escaped from the crate in midair and fell to his death. Very sad. Mm-hmm. But the next year, when they flew back over that area, they saw that beavers had created ponds and wetlands in all of the places where they dropped them. So it was actually really effective. You know, nobody's throwing beavers out of airplanes anymore. But in the 1940s, that was how it was done.
Is it hard to get them to take to a new location? Is it fairly simple?
Yeah, no, it can be hard. I mean, one of the challenges is that, you know, when you move a beaver to a new place, you know, he doesn't have his lodge and dam and pond, right? And he needs that lodge, that house, and that pond as shelter from predators, you know, from mountain lions and bears and coyotes and all kinds of other carnivores that like to eat beavers. So if you just drop a beaver in a new place, you know, there's definitely a risk that you know, it's going to get eaten by a mountain lion its first night out there. So, you know, moving beavers is it can be effective. It's certainly there are lots of examples of places where it's worked really well, but you know, there are also lots of examples of places where it hasn't been all that effective, unfortunately, because you know, so many of them have either gotten eaten or they've just, you know, moved on. They don't always like the places that you put them, and they, you know, they just keep moving.
Tell me what fascinates you about these creatures as architects.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think that, you know, look, beavers are so easy to empathize with, right? Like humans, they're just driven to relentlessly modify their own surroundings to improve their food and shelter. You know, that's what they do with their dams, and that's what we do with our roads and railroads and power lines and other infrastructure, right? But, you know, the difference is that beavers build in ways that are beneficial to all other species, right? They're creating these refuges, these shelters for fish and mammals and birds and amphibians and all kinds of other critters, where, of course, you know, our infrastructure is mostly detrimental to other life forms, right? We're wiping animals out, and they're creating habitat for other creatures. So, you know, in some ways, humans and beavers are really similar. We're both these relentless, almost instinctive builders, but in other ways, you know, our effects on the landscape are so different.
That was author Ben Goldfarb. His book is called Eager. More of this conversation will live online, including the author's thoughts on what to do when beavers cause flooding and damage that impacts human infrastructure. Well, wildfire season in South Dakota has expanded beyond the summer months. As we brace for the height of a new season, we may see more wildfire activity than we did last year. You remember last year when the Black Hills were lush and green well into late summer. Well, researcher Emily Fairfax wanted to examine the role of beavers in wildfire mitigation in a scientific context. She's with us now to discuss her paper, Smokey the Beaver, and she joins us via Zoom. Dr. Fairfax, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about what you were finding was missing in the scientific record regarding beavers and wildlife mitigation. Had studies been done, or was the evidence anecdotal? Where did you begin?
There was a lot of anecdata about beavers and fire, meaning that there were stories, there were photographs, there were accounts of beaver wetlands persisting through wildfire that date back hundreds and hundreds of years. But looking through the scientific literature and all the papers that have been published, there just wasn't anything that was putting a number to it and saying, you know, within our definition of science, like this is a thing and we need to pay attention to it. Beaver wetlands are fire resistant.
So, what did your research seek to find out, and how did you proceed with your methodology?
So, what I wanted to know was if beaver wetlands can really stay green and stay sort of preserved in their pre-fire state, even during wildfires. And I wanted to know, does this happen all the time, or is this something that only happens under really special conditions? So what I did was I used satellites to effectively go back in time to a bunch of different fires that had burned across the American West and look at them before and see what did the landscape look like all over, including around beaver ponds, and then look at these same landscapes after wildfire had come through and try to figure out what parts of the landscape were burnt and what parts were unburnt. And what I saw consistently over and over and over again across all these different landscape types and ecosystems and places and fire intensities was that no matter what else had gone on, these beaver wetlands were staying green. They were totally protected from the wildfires, even when the fires were really big and serious.
So, can it be generalized then? Is that information that scientists can use, that land managers can use?
Yeah, so far in my research, I keep looking for the case where it stops happening, where beavers are not able to keep their wetlands green. And I've expanded to look at megafires. I've expanded to look at other more really different ecosystem types like Ontario and Minnesota. And I'm still finding that these wetlands are green and they're protected from fire. And it's honestly kind of surprising how generalizable it is. But then you stop and you think and you're like, all right, well, these are very wet places in the landscape where the beavers have been doing fuel thinning. Like they're basically doing everything we do to mitigate fire just on their own and without direction.
So let's talk about that, because one of the ideas would be, let's emulate what the beaver does. We're human beings. We're also architects of our landscape. We can learn from them, but we don't actually need the beaver because they're also doing these other things that, you know, are destructive to us or get in our way. Like, we can't tell them where they're going to operate. Why do we need the animals themselves?
We need the beavers themselves because they are engineering the landscape in so many complex ways that honestly we still don't fully understand. We do engage in beaver mimicry, like building beaver dam analogs, structures that are supposed to look like a beaver dam and function like a beaver dam. And in many ways they do, but beavers don't just build dams. They're also chewing on trees. They're also digging canals. They're also moving sediment and mud all around. They're attracting all these other animals and keystone species to their habitats. And we are not able to mimic that in its entirety. We can mimic little pieces of it, but not the whole thing. And that's what the beaver does for us. And the beaver does it for free. And as unfortunate as it is, like the flooding that beavers cause, like that's one of the main sources of drought and fire protection. And so it really, I think we need to look for compromises with the beavers, like how much flooding is okay so that we get some benefits, but we also don't have our roads and basements underwater.
All right. So as a professor, as an educator, the importance and the challenge is always, how do you get this research into the world so that people can understand the importance, further the research as necessary, but then also use it in their day-to-day life? And you created this stop motion animation digital feature to explain science. So we're going to put it up on our Instagram page later on today. But if you want to just Google Emily Fairfax, you're going to find it on YouTube. Tell us a little bit about communicating your research to people in a way that you thought, okay, this is going to help people understand the complexity of this scientific research.
Yeah. So I talk about my research all the time. And I was finding myself constantly looking for like a visual, like I had this mental picture of what was going on and I wanted to show people that. And a lot of people like don't want to look at plots and graphs and maps all the time because it's like it can be boring, honestly. But I wanted this to be engaging and interesting. And I was like, you know what, let's do this with stop motion. I was a Girl Scout. I know how to sew felt and use construction paper and make crafts. Like, let's make this happen. And so I just set up on my kitchen table and made a stop motion video trying to summarize my research without using any words, without being an explainer, just like get the visual across of what are beavers doing. And it was really well received. I was so happy about it. I like put banjo music over a beaver because for whatever reason, every documentary about them has banjos playing when you are introduced to the beavers. So I was like, you know what, I'll go with it too. Maybe there's something there. And it worked. People really enjoyed it. And I got a lot of questions and engagement about beavers after that. So it felt like it opened the door to talk to people who maybe otherwise wouldn't have been as interested.
Talk a little bit about, because Ben Goldfarb was on before you, and I had a great conversation with him about just this work bringing you into the landscape, bringing you into nature. And you've been interested in science and ecology and water really since you were a very small kid. Tell me a little bit about how the science that you do, like how you became a scientist, but then also how the science that you do impacts how you live your life as a human being in the 21st century. I know that's a big question, but what did it bring up for you? Yeah.
So my mom tells me this story about how when I was a little bitty kid, I was so fascinated with science and I came to her one day very serious and I was like, here's the thing. I'm going to walk on the rings of Saturn, but I'm going to be careful and I'm going to bring my car seat. Like I was so, I just wanted to plan. In fact, like I was ready. I was ready to dive into science. And I've always, like it's stuck with me. I've always been ready. I've always also been very, you know, cognizant that nature is a powerful place and you have to be careful when you go out there to keep yourself safe and to also keep nature safe. And so that somewhat informs how I go into nature. Like I want to be part of it. I don't want to control it when I'm out there. I want to learn about it and learn from it. And then within my research specifically, like with climate change and fire and drought and all these disasters that I study, it can be really grim, but beavers are very hopeful. And when I talk about beavers, even in the context of devastating fire, like you can see people feel a little bit of hope. And that's what I really carry with myself into the field and into my research and my life is like, even when things are really challenging, like have hope and look for the unexpected helpers. Like if you asked me 10 years ago if a beaver was going to help with wildfire, I'd have been like, what? Say what? And now I'm like, you know what? That makes sense. What are the other beavers out there? In big quotes, other beavers. Like, what about bison? What about prairie dogs? What about these other ecosystem engineers that probably could help us out if we just give them a chance? Mm.
Dr. Emily Fairfax, we have enjoyed talking to you. I hope you'll come back and visit with us in the future. Again, for listeners, we're going to put a link to her paper, Smokey the Beaver, up on our website. We're going to put her stop motion digital feature on our Instagram page at SDPB News. So look for that there today, this afternoon, and throughout the weekend. We'll probably drop some things there. But Dr. Fairfax, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.
If you're going to go to Saturn, bring your car seat. That's the lesson for the day. We'll take a break. More in the moment, where we explore our relationship with the beaver, is coming up next. We're going to zoom the lens in a little bit on Western South Dakota specifically after the break. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Next, we will take in the view from the banks and waterways of the Black Hills of South Dakota. Lori Brown is a Western South Dakota rangeland specialist with the Nature Conservancy. Also joining us today, Patty Lynch. She's a former wildlife biologist for the U.S. Forest Service in the Black Hills, and both are gathered around the table in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Lori Brown, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I just want to say, every time I go around the Black Hills, people tell me, have you had Lori Brown on the show yet? So I'm very glad that we were able to make that happen. Patty Lynch, thanks for being here as well. I'm excited to meet you.
Thank you for inviting us.
All right, Lori, we have dedicated an entire hour of In the Moment to understanding beavers in Western South Dakota. When did you become interested in this powerful rodent and how it bemuses and irritates us and maddens us, but then also saves us in certain ways? Where did you come to this conversation?
I think that I became a beaver believer about five or six years ago. And my journey is a bit similar to Ben's. I read his book when I was first getting into this wonderful rodent. And that kind of took me down a rabbit hole of learning more and more and more. I similarly attended a beaver workshop in Colorado in the Gunnison Basin and learned about all of the amazing beaver mimicry work they were doing up there for critical sage-grouse habitat. And it just became clear to me through this learning journey how important this species was to help us really do habitat restoration at a meaningful scale, and in a way that is cost-effective and user-friendly as well. So it really became a natural solution for a lot of our land management challenges that we face in the West.
Patty, do you have a beaver origin story of your own?
Well, I became interested in beaver when I first came to the district in 1998. My boss took me out to an area where he and an engineer had put in several trying to simulate beaver with boulders and some gravel to back up a drainage that was mostly dry. It had, a little trickle for probably about 400 yards. And so they had put in these structures to try to mimic the beaver, to hold back the water. The area is Teepee Creek, if anybody's been there. It is now very lush. We have a lot more water going down the stream into Battle Creek. And lots more vegetation that's been stimulated by the high water tables that are created by these structures. Beaver, just as Ben said, are phenomenal at and doesn't cost money to create that same environment to allow vegetation to return to the stream side.
So we know about the fur trade and how different this landscape used to be before 400 million beavers were trapped and removed from the landscape for their pelts. But we also do not have, this is not an endangered species. Do we have any idea how many beavers are in the Black Hills? Do we have an idea of what the population, I don't know which one of you might know that, but give us an idea of like how many are there?
Well, the Forest Service developed this monitoring protocol back in 2004 that was statistically supposed to tell us how many beaver were on the landscape. And in 2007, they ran that survey, and there were about 38 beaver caches found during the survey. And this includes also parts of Wyoming and on the national forest lands. This year, and it's preliminary, but they only found 16. In 2012, you know, they had, I think, 60 around that number. So we've seen a drop in beaver caches. Now, some of that survey could be also surveyor error and not being able to detect caches due to light or other factors. But it's a pretty good indication our beavers are not doing that good in the Black Hills.
So, Lori, talk a little bit about people's attitude toward beavers, because just in the Rapid City Journal earlier this year, I think it was in February, people were talking about Rapid Creek and damage to trees and how are they going to, you know, do any kind of beaver management. This is something that when people see evidence of a beaver, they're often concerned.
Yeah, I'll start by saying that when I first started doing this beaver work with the Nature Conservancy in partnership with some of our federal organizations, we all recognized the importance of beaver. And even 4 or 5 years ago, we're like, okay, just don't say beaver. Just don't mention that word, because we were so nervous about how people would react to it. And we didn't want to scare people away from doing stream restoration because they didn't want to bring beaver back. So they are very much viewed as a nuisance species by a lot of people. But more and more, as I spend more time in this community and spend more time talking to folks, to landowners, to hunters, to anglers, to just concerned citizens in general, I'm seeing and experiencing this tremendous support for the species, and I see and talk to more people who really value the ecosystem services they provide. So I'll say that it is still a delicate conversation at times, and there's definitely outspoken opponents and concerns, but more and more I think that we as a community are recognizing the value that they bring to our home, to the Black Hills, and how important they are. So I can't say that we're all beaver believers yet, but I definitely feel like there's momentum in that direction as we start to see the need and the value for them here.
Yeah, we're going to talk at the end of the hour to a landowner who was a trapper and is now trying to figure out different ways to rethink beavers on his landscape. But Lori, tell me a little bit about what the Nature Conservancy is doing for stream restoration work now. What are some of your programs?
So the Nature Conservancy started about 4 or 5 years ago, trying to experiment with beaver mimicry in this landscape. We knew that structures like beaver dam analogs had been effective in other western states, in Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, and Idaho. But we didn't really know what that looked like in a local context. Our stream systems and our watersheds are not a one-to-one comparison for what happens in Wyoming and Montana. So we really wanted to take these techniques and these tools and bring them to our community. So we started partnering with local landowners, primarily folks engaged in ranching and livestock production, and experiment and test and demonstrate how we can best implement beaver dam analogs, another sort of what we call low-tech, low-cost restoration structures out here, and learn how we can start to move towards a more self-sustaining stream system. So we've installed quite a few of these structures across the land, both in the grasslands and some structures in the Black Hills as well, with the Forest Service as a partner, and have really seen some impressive short-term benefits already.
Yeah, Patty, talk about partnerships and how important collaboration and listening and, you know, the latest science, but also, you know, giving room for people's concerns. As a former Forest Service wildlife biologist, I mean, you've worked for this place that's the people's landscape. That's, you know, that this land belongs to you and me. So you probably are pretty well versed in the language of collaboration. Tell me.
Well, the Black Hills National Forest Plan that was amended in 2005 basically identified the beaver as a management indicator species, what's supposed to tell, kind of a keystone species to tell, keep track of the health of our stream systems and, of course, the ecosystem that it supports on its own. So we've worked very hard to maintain beaver on the landscape. We've put in beaver structures such as the BDAs. I call them BDAs, but anyway, the point being is we work very hard. We do get most of our problems come with complaints. We'll get a phone call from a landowner that's concerned about a beaver that's on national forest land. We usually go out and look at it and see if there's anything we can do to mitigate their concerns. And like we've installed what they call beaver pond levelers. We've installed various structures such as, you know, hot electrical wire to prevent them from building next to a culvert. We've even replaced culverts, the size of them, because we know we're not going to get the beaver out of that. It's perfect habitat. And so there's a lot of things you can do to help mitigate and keep beaver on the landscape. Sometimes we've even, you know, told the landowner, you just need to put chicken wire against your ornamentals that you don't want to see go down. But we try to work with them, and we want to see them on the landscape because of that management indicator status.
So because of that status, if you know that the caches are, you know, declining, is that also an indication, potentially, that the health of the Black Hills National Forest is that a canary in a coal mine, I guess is what I'm asking. Like, how close is that connection between how well the beavers are doing and how well the forest is doing? Help me understand that, please.
Well, I mean, in terms of the survey, you know, we would, as a management indicator species, it's not retaining its resilience on the landscape. You know, there were we organized a beaver working group with the State Fish and Game and other entities in terms of trying to figure out what was happening to the beaver, because the biologists were all concerned, and so was the state, that we paid to help the state do their survey in the Black Hills last October. And so we try working with landowners, with the state, anybody that wants to be a partner, and we just work with them. But it's not a good sign. Our riparian areas have degraded. Wherever you walk along a stream, you can find remnants of beaver dams, and a lot of them. And we're just not seeing them in some drainages where those beaver dams once were.
Lori, tell me a little bit about collaboration, because the Nature Conservancy has worked with South Dakota State University Extension and the U.S. Department of Agriculture to help put out information about stream management and health. Tell me a little bit about collaboration in your work.
From day one, our work has been a very locally led initiative. We focus a lot on the co-creation of conservation management practices and initiatives. And if what we're thinking about or developing isn't a good fit for a rancher or a landowner, then there's no really point in us pursuing it any further. It has to be a true co-creation process. And I work with some amazing, amazing colleagues, like you mentioned, at South Dakota State University and with the federal agencies. And we all support each other and lean into each other and have our own strength and resilience because of those partnerships and because of those collaborations. The Nature Conservancy doesn't manage very much land. We have a small preserve, but we really have to work with and partner with the Forest Service and Game, Fish, and Parks and we have wonderful local staff here in Western South Dakota to partner with. They're the type of folks that kind of fill your cup back up, I want to say. Mm-hmm. I oftentimes leave a meeting and I'm just incredibly inspired by the wonderful natural resource managers that I get to work with every single day.
So Lori, tell me what isn't talked about that you just wish people understood about beavers.
That's a really good question. And I think some of it is a bit what Ben and Emily spoke about, the role that beaver play in fire mitigation, in natural water storage. There's very tangible economic values that we can tie to keeping beaver on the landscape. Rapid Creek provides drinking water for Rapid City, and having beaver in that watershed help us have a more secure water supply and help mitigate some of the devastating effects that fire can have in this landscape. So I think one of the most important messages is that we all recognize that these beaver have tremendous benefits for us as a community on an individual level and on a landscape level as well. Mm.
Patty, what would you want to leave people with that is something that you just wish people could understand about this animal and what it means to the landscape and to humans?
Yeah, I'm going to reiterate, you know, Lori's comments, Ben's, Emily. Just that they're really cool creatures. They deserve a chance. It's been very difficult on the Black Hills because of the amount of roads we have and the drainage is to make sure that we don't have issues where beaver are, you know, damming up a road, a culvert, or flooding someone's home. We work really hard for that and wish just people would start to discover how great they are. I mean, they're a natural engineer, and they can do far more, a lot cheaper than what we could do.
All right. We are going to talk with the landowner about those natural engineers in a moment. But first, thank you to Lori Brown, Western South Dakota Rangeland Specialist with the Nature Conservancy, and Patty Lynch, former wildlife biologist for the U.S. Forest Service in the Black Hills. Lori, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Patty, I look forward to talking to you again as well. More in the moment after the break on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, beaver management creates tension among advocates, landowners, and urban planners in South Dakota. Pat Guptill is a Pennington County landowner who once saw the beaver as the enemy. Now he is seeking to understand how to work alongside the rodents for ecological and economic good. The Guptill family received recognition for their voluntary conservation efforts and are recipients of the Leopold Conservation Award. Pat Guptill now joins us on the phone. Pat, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for the invite.
Tell us a little bit about your operation at the Guptill Ranch.
We run a livestock operation, cow-calves, yearlings, custom cattle, intensive grazing, in just a family-run operation.
And you were a trapper for many years. Why were you removing beavers from the landscape? Why was that important to you at the time?
I guess basically I was uneducated in. And I would listen to the people that say beaver were bad. So I just learned to trap, which was a mistake, I know now. But the biggest deal is when I started trapping on my place, I could see what happened when the beaver were there. And even after I trapped them out, I'd seen how they had already repaired the creek within 6 to 8 months. They would do a pretty good repair job on the creek. So I got to thinking that maybe we should be leaving them alone and maybe promote them a little bit. Hmm.
Was there a turning point of meeting other people that helped you understand, or was it mostly your own observation, conversation with family members? What was the turning point for you?
Well, just observing what was happening with the creek that runs through our place, I've been here 30 plus years, and in that time, the creek has went deeper by anywhere between 2 to 4 feet. And I know that's not right, and the only way to stop that is to dam it up. And the best dam builders it's God created, we trapped out. So we're promoting the beaver now, and then I've had, well, Lori, talking to Lori Brown, I mean, she educated me probably more than anybody else ever has on beaver and what our creek should actually look like. So, I mean, it was over time, and then visiting with other people.
Yeah. What are the ways that you promote the beaver?
Well, basically, I quit trapping them. I mean, that's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
And one of the other things that we've done here with our intensive rotation is we've created ecosystem that doesn't allow water to run off. It soaks down into the grassland. We have organic matter down a lot deeper, so we can take a pretty good rainfall. We've had a 3-inch rainfall in less than an hour and never lost any water. It stays on our land, which in turn helps feed the beaver or the creeks. And the beaver hold that water up, and behind the beaver dams, I've noticed that it has plants that scrub the water, take the impurities out of the water. And I mean, there's just so many benefits to have a beaver around. It's just, we don't even know them all yet.
Does it create forage for the cattle? How does it impact with cattle grazing or doesn't it? Help me understand that.
At this time, we really don't haven't had the beaver long enough to create that situation. I'm sure it will help. But one of the things it does is it has open water year-round and clean water, because they come through the beaver dams, and that scrubs the water. And so we have water for wildlife and water for cattle. But as far as the forage, that remains to be seen, which I'm pretty sure we will see more forage above them.
What do you want your children to know about being caretakers of this land in the future?
Well, the biggest thing is God created this ecosystem that we're living in. And we as man have tried to make it better, and all we've done is messed it up. We need to go back and think about what God designed for our landscape and what was put here to take care of it, which was the buffalo. And that's kind of what we've been trying to do is go back to what God created. We'll never get there, but we're trying to get there as best as possible.
Pat Guptill from Pennington County. His family is a recipient of the 2013 Leopold Conservation Award. And I want to say thank you so much for your time and telling us a little bit about these wonderful acres in western South Dakota. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. We have a ton of resources that went into the production of this hour. We're going to put links for you up on our website so that you can do research of your own. And you're always welcome to reach out to the In the Moment team and by sending us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. Follow us on Instagram at @sdpbnews. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. SDPB's news director is Josh Chilson. Our videographer, Jordan Henderson. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. From all of us at SDPB, we thank you for listening.